on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, here's KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Portfolio Manager, Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our Monday, April 20th edition of InvestTalk. This is above average investing for the average investor. And as we say on our website, investtalk.com, InvestTalk is the place to become a better investor, where reason and common sense prevail. And I think that's key. That last part is key. You know, becoming a better investor, that's a very general term. But what does that ultimately come down to? How do you become a better investor? Some people become a better investor by just trading. And it takes them, and that's ultimately speculation, but they're obviously trying to make money. But for us here, we're trying to instill common sense and reason into everybody so they don't get caught up in hype and make bad decisions and make sure that they're grounded in reality. So we're going to talk about that today. You know, this is a forum. We try to make it worth your time spent. We exchange ideas. We keep you current on relevant investment news. We answer your questions live on the radio, via email, or our 24-hour listener line. So there's multiple ways that you can get in touch with us and ask your question. And that's our ultimate goal here, is to figure out what you want to hear and give you the best information that we can with the best perspective that we can as well. Now, if you're investing these days, it's because you're listening to this program, right? But a new survey from Bankrate says 52% of Americans don't own stocks. 52%. Now, for many, the reason is, the most common reason given is that they don't have the money to invest. Others say it's too complicated, which that's very understandable because it can be these days. One-fifth of the 52% say they lack sufficient knowledge about stocks, and 7% say it's too risky. I appreciate the crowd that says they lack sufficient knowledge, because that's good perspective. Some people think they have enough knowledge when they really don't. And that's worse than those that realize they don't have the knowledge to do it. Okay, so you got to figure out where you are and what level, if you do get knowledge, what type of knowledge do you need to get? What type of knowledge do you need to get to feel comfortable investing in stocks? Not just for yourself, but when you're talking about professionals, what type of knowledge do professionals have? And you need to get somewhere in that neighborhood before you can be successful as well. Now, 7% of these listeners say that it's too risky. That's admirable as well, because knowing your risk tolerance is important. So if you don't have the risk tolerance for it, you shouldn't be invested in that. But you need to know your risk tolerance first. Now, another 9% say they don't trust their stockbroker or advisor. And that's understandable in the days of brokers who have a lot of conflicts of interest. There's a lot of legislation now from the White House trying to change the expected responsibilities from advisors. And it's called fiduciary responsibility. And brokers don't have that. Advisors like us do have that, meaning they have to put the client's interests first before their own. Where stockbrokers, they don't need to do that right now, but the Obama administration is trying to do that. So I see where they're coming from, that 9% don't trust their advisors. So Lauren Gensler of Forbes put together some numbers to make the case for investing, even on a small scale. She says, if you were to invest just $1,000 a year starting at age 25, earning 8%, you would have nearly $280,000 by the time you retire at 65. Now, the majority of that sum, 85%, would be thanks to investment returns. Think about that. It's pretty high. Now, what's your experience investing? How old were you when you started? I'd love to hear your investing story, your questions as well. We try to answer them with our 24-hour listener line. Or you can talk to us live Monday through Friday, 4 to 5 Pacific time. 888-99-CHART is how to reach us.
Hi, my name is Craig. I'm calling from Columbus, Indiana, listening via podcast. I'm 23 years old and have been looking for a way to get into the market here and was curious there on your thoughts on what would be the best way of getting started and investing here, looking forward towards my retirement. Appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Well, I think the first thing you need to do is open up an IRA, Roth IRA. If you're in a low tax bracket, probably a Roth IRA would make sense. And just put in a certain amount of money per month. Maybe you have a lump sum you want to put in. I think the limit is $5,500 this year. So put the money in there. And how to get started? Well, the first thing I would probably just do is buy a broad ETF, whether it's SPY, whether it's ACWI, which is the All World Index, whether it's DIA, the Dow, whatever it is. Just get a sense of something of how the market works. How do you purchase a stock? How it moves? What dividends come in? How do those work? Things like that, and start putting just dollar cost average every time you accumulate $500, go in and buy a certain amount of shares of certain ETF, and then as you get into a decent amount of that, maybe $3,000-$5,000. Then you start maybe diversifying yourself into another ETF, something that's maybe less correlated or not as correlated. And in the meantime, just get educated. That's the most important thing. What are the different asset classes? How do they work? What are the risk levels? What are the secular drivers? What are the cyclical drivers of each asset class? And when I say cyclical, that's the ebbs and flows, risk on versus risk off of particular asset classes, where everyone likes this asset, and then this cycle turns the other way and people start not liking that asset, and that gets to an extreme. And then secular is long-term trends. So interest rates, the secular trend going forward is going to be probably higher interest rates. To what extent? It's hard to know, but that's going to be the trend there. And then when come the different sectors, is biotech, what's that secular trend going to be like? Technology, energy, those type of trends are important to know as well. So start small, start basic with ETFs, educate yourself about the market, and start broadening your expertise. And then when you feel comfortable buying individual names, then you can go out and do that as well. Now think of an ETF as a cross between a mutual fund and a stock. Many people do. But there's more to it, and that's why today we're going to talk about why ETFs are good and sometimes they're bad. So that's our main talking point today, but I also have some other ones as well. I want to talk about junk bonds. Is this where the next financial crisis is coming from? Junk bond sector. We're going to talk about the trends in that particular area of the marketplace, what you should look for in the next few years, and how there might be major problems ahead for that particular sector, and you need to watch out for it. So we're going to talk about that. And then dividends, dividend yields. Everyone's in love with dividends. Everyone wants dividends. And many times you might be comparing two different companies. They may be in the same sector, same area of the marketplace, and they have dividend. They both pay dividends. Many people say, oh, well, this pays a higher percentage than that company. Well, then I'm going to buy this one because the yield is better. It's not a good way to think about it. So we're going to touch on why is that? What are the factors to consider when trying to decide whether you should invest in one company that pays a dividend versus another company that pays a dividend? So we're going to talk about that. And then also mortgage rates. 30-year versus 15-year. A lot of people are interested in this because rates are very low. There's various avenues and products that you can use to finance the purchase of a home or maybe just the ongoing ownership of a home. And comparing 30-year and 15-year, I think, are is an important thing to do for everybody. Some are right for 30 years are right for some people, and 15 years are right for another. And then there's kind of hybrids in between, so we're going to talk about that as well. But ultimately, I want to hear from you. 888-99-CHART is our number, 888-992-4278. That's how you get through and ask your question. On today's show, we have about 45 minutes left to get your call in, but please do it sooner rather than later. Now, let's take a quick look at today's market. You had the Dow up 208 points, S&P up 19, NASDAQ up 62. Pretty nice broad-based rally for the markets overall. The Morningstar U.S. Market Index was up about 0.9%, so a little less than 1%. And that was after a large rebound from a pretty nasty sell-off on Friday. It was not a pretty sell-off on Friday across the board. A lot of worries with Greece and China, etc. And then over the weekend, China lowered the reserve requirements. Do you know what that is? What a reserve requirement is? Well, you should know if you are investing in the markets, because you should have enough knowledge. You should know those type of things to understand different economies. And the reserve requirement is how much banks need to hold on to their deposits. So they have a deposit base of clients, right? And they can lend out a certain percentage of that. Usually it's over 80% that they can lend out. But they banks have to hold on to anywhere from maybe 5 to 20% of that money as reserves, reserve requirements. And the lower that percentage is that they have to hold on to, the more that they can lend out to the economy, and it gets the economy going, etc. So what China did is they lowered that reserve requirement, meaning there's more capacity now for banks to go out and lend and hopefully improve the economic performance of their market. So that is what is going on over in China, and that's what sparked our rally here in the U.S. Now, coming up this Saturday in San Jose is our Saturday Morning Wealth Conference. It's called Global Value Investing, Finding Opportunities in Foreign, Domestic, and Emerging Markets. It's very difficult today to find a lot of values here in America. There are some, but they're few and far between, and there's a lot more overseas. So we're going to talk about that. We'll be at the San Jose Hyatt House from 9 to noon this Saturday, and you can register right now on investtalk.com. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Let's talk about ETFs. Now, they're often described as a cross between mutual funds and stocks, and there's some validity to that. They came on the scene back in the early 90s, and they've grown to about a $2 trillion in total holdings at the end of 2014. So that's a lot of money. That's still dwarfed by the $16 trillion that's in mutual funds. But there's more and more each year. They went from about 1,300 in the end of 2013 to a little over 1,400 at the end of last year. So decent growth rate there. That's still dwarfed by the mutual fund industry, which has about 8,000 funds, a little less than 8,000 funds. And the one good thing about ETFs is that it creates easy diversification across each share. There's various types of asset classes you can invest in. And in a lot of ways that you couldn't see before. You can see the intraday moves and the volume. That's big. And their expense ratios are very low, which is it's a big positive. You know, mutual funds, a lot of times they have minimum investments of $500, $3,000. And there's no minimums like that for an ETF. You just buy one share. So that's a positive. Then you can short ETFs. So maybe you don't want to short an individual name, but you want to short a broad sector, say for right now, like biotechs, where that's super overvalued. You don't have to pick one particular company. You can short the whole market. So they're great tools. Everybody should be considering them if they're trying to get exposure to a certain asset class. Now you're listening to Invest Talk. Coming up on the second half of Invest Talk, we're going to talk about asset classes. What exactly are they? Give us a call, 888-99-CHART.
Our podcast distribution is made possible every day by KPP Financial, Steve Peasley, President. And if you're an InvestTalk insider, then you've already received Steve's latest portfolio management piece called Psychology and Investing.
It's the latest offering for InvestTalk insiders. Why not sign up yourself? It's free on InvestTalk.com.
Now, InvestTalk is a two-way conversation, but if you have a question between programs, you can still ask us on the next InvestTalk. We're here for you at 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Steve and Justin. This is Dave. I'm a podcast listener from Denver. I love the show. I just have a couple questions for you guys. The first being, I own a position in Alaskan Air Group, and I was wondering if you would recommend a buy, sell, or hold with where they're at right now. That's ALK. And I also have been reading a lot about Ron Paul's prediction that there will be a full economic currency crisis this year, and I wanted to know what you guys thought about that and his opinions on the matter. Thanks. I'll be listening on the show.
All right. He's looking at Alaska Airlines. Most people know who they are. It's a pretty big airline. Their market cap is, let's see, it's about $8.3 billion, yields about 1%, and that's pretty good. They've been going up broadly because of the whole airline industry, really. Has been doing well because there's been a lot of consolidation, and with consolidation in industry brings less competition, right? There's less companies out there to compete on different what do they call them, lines or routes. There we go, routes that they service, and they've been doing well because of it. They're at record operating revenues, operating cash flows. Their margins are really at the highest they've ever been. Net margins are over 11%. They've never been that high. Back before the financial crisis, 2006, 2007, you know, even when the economy good, their margins were negative to slightly positive, and they've been getting better ever since. So you're at record high margins, and the big question is that going to continue? Are they going to be able to continue to improve their margins? Is their return equity going to go back to something like, you know, into the negative territory like it was in 2005 and 2006, or is it going to stay at 29% like it is now? I'm more in the camp that at some point you're going to have issues. Historically, airlines are commodities. Now everyone thinks commodities as gold and oil and, you know, natural resources. Well, a service can be a commodity as well when there's no differentiating factor between one or another. And that's really the case in the airline industry, I think, for the most part. You know, there's some people have an affinity towards one airline or another, but nobody's going to spend 10, 20, 30% more on a particular ticket on a consistent basis for one airline over another, because they're just getting you from point A to point B. Obviously, if there's safety concerns, etc. But I mean, the airline industry is so safe nowadays, that's not really a consideration. So Alaska is not it's one of the better names. I like that. It is one of the better names because I think they're smaller, more nimble. Their routes are a little more specialized. The more routes you have, the more chances you have for routes that are unprofitable, and so Alaska kind of keeps those pretty tight. So I like that airline, but I don't like the industry over the long term. Now, the short to medium term, the consolidation could continue to have an effect, but in a recession, if you have a recession, that's going to go out the window. You've had poor bookings over the first quarter. You've had been driven up a lot by the drop in oil prices, because that's about a third of their cost is oil prices or fuel. And so it's been going up because oil price is going down. It's supposed to improve margins. Well, that's true, but a lot of that has been baked in. And if oil prices start to rebound, you're going to see this go back down. So I would say, you say you own it, I would take some off the table. I would take probably most of it off the table. And I would have probably a 8 to 10% trailing stop on it, and because I don't like the industry historically. My grandfather, he was, you know, in the investing game for decades. He hates airlines. He will not invest in an airline. I don't know if KP Financial has ever invested in airline. I don't think we have, because we just don't like the sector, because like I said, it's a commodity type of business. And we don't like that for the long term. Margins tend to be around zero over the long term, because there's not a lot of differentiating factors. So I would stay away from Alaska Airlines. That's ALK, Alaska Air Group. Now let's talk quickly about junk bonds. Junk bonds, and it's been investors' area of choice over the past 5 years, because as the central banks have lowered interest rates to next to nothing, everyone can't get any yield out of their corporate bonds, out of CDs, out of all the ways that typically retirees and investors were getting yield before. And so what do? They go out and chase yield. They chase yield. They go and say, okay, where can I get dividends? Where can I get interest on a consistent basis? And everyone looks to fixed income, and they say, well, corp bonds are only yielding 2, 3, 4%. I need 6, 7, 8%. And they go in the junk bonds. And Jeffrey Gundlach of Double Line Capital, known as the king of the bond market, he has a warning, and we're going to talk about his point of view as well as my point of view, and where and when you might be seeing some issues going forward. Give us a call, 888-99-CHART. This is InvestTalk. Your questions come first, whether you have a stock, strategy, or just want to know whether you should convert from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. Whatever it is you want to talk about when it comes to financial wellness, financial investing, we are here for you at 888-99-CHART.
Yes, hi. Daniel in Palo Alto. Listen to you on Talk 20 religiously. Just a quick question. I wanted to ask you about stock symbol RRC, Range Resources. It would be a natural gas play, and just whether you felt that area was a kind of a hot potato that should be avoided for the time being or an area to invest in. Thanks, Steve. Bye-bye.
8899. Oh, sorry. I was trying to install something. CRR. That's my natural instinct right there. A Range Resources, that's what it is. RRC. I got distracted for a second. RRC, Range Resources. This is a company, this is a oil and gas company. And their yield's about 0.25%, so not a big yielder there. And this is a shale company. It's Texas-based, independent natural gas. Natural gas liquids and oil company engaged in exploration, development, and acquisition of primarily gas properties in southwestern and Appalachian regions of the United States. So, decent-sized company, $10 billion market cap, and they have declined from about $90 and chain, $94 or so a share back in middle of 2014 when oil prices were still hovering around $100 a barrel, and fell to as low as $44 a barrel, or not a barrel, $44 a share in about, let's see, what was that, February? March? Mid-March. So they've had a pretty big rally from $45 up to $60 a share, about a 33% rally. I like Range Resources. It's large enough. It has a moat, meaning that they have some acreage. They have some land that has a lot of value, has a lot of resources underneath it that they can tap. And they allocate capital well, which is good. Now, you know, obviously the decline in the market price has a lot to do with oil, and the recovery in the price will have a lot to do with oil as well. So the big question is, do you want to add oil exposure to your portfolio? Now, this is not a dividend payer. I am a bigger fan of adding dividend paying stocks when you're talking about natural resource plays, especially oil, because there's so many of them out there. So to me, it's high risk because it is shale related, meaning their marginal cost to produce is probably higher than the average. the average oil company out there. Think of the Exxons and Chevrons of the world. So, you know, that would be a safer play. This would be a more leveraged play to the price of oil. If oil stays hovering down here in the $50 to $60 a barrel range for extended period of time, well, you know, that could be an issue for a name like this. But if we recover in the $70, $80 a barrel range, you'll see some good growth in a name like Range Resources. So I think it's a higher risk name. Wouldn't be my first choice, but it is one of the better shale plays out there. So it's a quality shale play is the way I would look at it. So like I said, not my first choice, but I do like it overall. Let's talk a little bit about junk bonds. I'm going to relate it a little bit to dividend yield, finding yields. How are you going to do that? You know, everyone's looking for yields because interest rates are so low, and they see treasuries yielding less than 1% on very short-term treasuries. And they say, okay, well, I need yield. I need 5, 6, 7, 8% yield from steady assets, which most people think fixed income, bonds, they think those are steady. Well, the junk bond sector is not necessarily so. And in that search for yield, investors have really been throwing caution to the wind just to get that steady yield. And that's just not a smart long-term capital allocation strategy. Now, in the short term, fine. Anything in the short to medium term can divorce itself from reality and divorce itself from the fundamentals. But in the long term, that's really what plays out, is the fundamentals of the particular company, sector, economy, etc. And Jeffrey Gundlach, he's a billionaire, and he is the CEO of Double Line Capital. He predicted the subprime crisis. He's called the king of the bond market. He says that higher interest rates and a wall of maturities are really going to throw a big monkey wrench into the junk bond world. And he says in the near term, it's probably not going to be that big of a deal. But starting in late 2017, 2018, 2019, you're going to have a $600 billion wall of junk bond maturity, meaning all these companies that have borrowed money at low interest rates during QE, during the height of quantitative easing, when money is super easy to get and cheap like it is now. Well, when interest rates are higher and money's not as abundant, well, guess what? That it's going to be much harder to refinance those bonds when they do mature, and it can cause a lot of problems. And he says one small spark can cause investors to run for the exits, as they fear higher interest rates will make it harder for companies to roll over or refinance that debt. Now, and one of the other issues is that junk bonds, really, they haven't only been around since about the 80s, early to mid-80s, is when they really started to gain popularity. And guess what? Interest rates were much, much higher back then. So you don't really have any precedent for what happens to junk bonds in a rising interest rate environment. I'm not talking about, rising over, you know, in 1 year or in a couple of years. I'm talking a secular trend, right? I talked about earlier about secular versus cyclical. Obviously, interest rates can move up and down on a cyclical basis, but generally, secularly, they run in 30-year increments, 30 years up, 30 years down. And you're going to start going into an environment where interest rates are going to rise, and it's going to be interesting to see how junk bonds react during that type of interest rates hiking cycle over the long term. So that can be an issue. And this will hit mom and pop investors for several reasons. There's a lot of exposure in 401k plans, in brokerage accounts, through ETFs like HYG, etc. And that could be a big issue. And then finally, he has a warning about master limited partnerships. He says these are very complicated enterprises. They pay out big dividends and are heavily leveraged. Something we've talked about a lot here. A lot of leverage, very complex, and margins can collapse very quickly. Dividends can be cut very quickly. The tax implications are different, and that's a very high-risk area of the marketplace. And also mall REITs. He says malls are in a secular decline, which I thoroughly agree with, and that can be it's going to be a big issue over the long term. Like I said, short, medium term, anything can happen, but long term, the eventual fallout from the mall industry will hit, and that'll probably be during the next recession. Let's go talk to Al in Buena Park. How you doing, Al?
I'm doing well. Thank you, sir, for taking my call.
Thanks for making it.
I wanted to ask you about Kraft, K-R-F-T. It's got a giant P-E. Mm-hmm. It's paying a small dividend, I think 2.5%, and it has had a rocket ship ride just recently. Mm-hmm. It is a sector play, as you've been speaking about. I'm wondering if you can give me some information. I do own quite a bit because I own the old parent of it. Mm-hmm. I've done well. I'd like to keep my money. How about that?
So you're trying to figure out whether you should take some money off the table, is what you're saying.
Yes, sir.
Right.
I believe it's up. It's been up about $30 in less than 3 weeks, or maybe a month.
Yeah, the forward PE is about 24, which is kind of
that's pretty high. Lower.
Yeah, for a company whose, you know, their earnings growth is not exactly gangbusters. It's pretty modest, to say the least. And I know, wasn't there another company that, maybe it was Kraft. Didn't Kraft have a big deal with, like, Warren? I'm trying to remember the news on that.
I believe it was. It was somebody big. I can't remember now. It wasn't the big Warren, mm-hmm. but it was somebody else. Thank you for refreshing my memory, young man.
Was it
thank
Kraft or was it or was it Heinz? Or which one was it? I'm trying to remember which one it was.
It was Heinz, yes, sir.
It was Heinz.
So
you're getting a lot. What you're getting here is a lot of reverberation in the industry because of the Heinz deal, and there's a lot of speculation now that Kraft will get taken over, and other companies, consumer staple type of names. You know, these companies that have a steady revenue base, they're large, they have big balance sheets, they can probably take on more debt because they'll be easy to borrow. Investors will be lining up.
As you said, they're going to have a constant stream. I've done well with it. If I can hang on to it, I will. It's just going to keep paying me.
Yeah, well, you're talking about
a
constant.
I make more than buying bonds or putting it in the bank.
Well, at this level though, you're only yielding about 2.5%. So you got to remember that as well.
Better than a bank.
Yeah, that is better than a bank, but there are also a lot of better yielding opportunities out there, even in this space, even in the kind of consumer staples area. You know, I don't want to give you specific names, but there are definitely better names in this area that you could sell this, redeploy all of that capital at a higher yield, probably a cheaper valuation, probably better growth, and you'll get a better yield there. So, yes, it's better than bank, you know, whatever the bank's giving you. But is it better than what else you could allocate that capital to? And that's something a lot of people don't realize. They say, oh, I'm happy with this because it's yielding X percent. Well, what are the alternatives out there from a risk-reward standpoint? And I think from Kraft's standpoint, I don't think this is a great risk-reward. In the short to medium term, it looks fine, and there probably will still continue to be a little bit of a positive hangover effect, shall you say, from the Heinz deal. For the likes of Kraft, but I think long term you could probably find a better value in the similar space and with better yield.
I appreciate you taking the time to explain that to me and enabling me to find another a player in that same space as you were speaking about earlier. I thank you for that very much, sir.
No problem.
I really
appreciate it. Actually,
thank you again.
No problem. And just in a little bit, I'm actually going to touch on one of those. A similar type of story. It has to do with AT&T and Verizon. And that same type of thinking that you have to have. I want to touch on this. It's going to come up after the next break before we close the show. And I'm going to talk about why sometimes that yield isn't the number one factor. Whether it's a worse yield or a better yield, it's all about the company you are investing in and whether they are doing right by you. The shareholder ultimately doing right by you. Now it's time for Invest Talk 101. What are asset classes? Now, Investopedia defines it as a group of securities that exhibit similar characteristics, behave similarly in the marketplace, and are subject to the same laws and regulations. The three main asset classes are equities, fixed income, and cash equivalents. Now, some folks would also include real estate and commodities in that that area. You know, whatever the asset class is, each one is expected to reflect different risk and return investment characteristics and will perform differently in any given market environment. So some are more subject to recessions, interest rates, etc., than the others. Now, asset classes and asset class categories are often mixed together. In other words, describing large cap stocks or short-term bonds asset classes is incorrect. These investment vehicles are asset class categories of a larger asset class and are used for diversification purposes. You know, not just because you're in equities, one person in equities, their risk profile is not the same as another person that's also invested in equities. So there's all these different shades of gray, like fixed income, bonds. Not all bonds are treated the same, like I talked earlier with junk bonds, right? So why is it important to understand asset classes? Well, one of the things you're trying to accomplish with diversification is to avoid the tendency of certain asset classes to move in tandem. You try to have that diversification. One zigs and the other zags. And if you have too much into a certain asset class, you're likely to get hurt at some point and make a rash decision. That's important as well. Now, a development that hurts housing, for example, could hurt mortgage lenders as well. So it's good to own sectors that aren't overly correlated to one particular area of the marketplace. We talked about back in 2005, 2006, everyone wanted to leverage up their personal balance sheet by borrowing against their house, buying other properties, etc., and they were leveraging themselves to one area of the marketplace too much. So your investment portfolio should act the same, right? And certain factors can affect different subsectors of asset categories. For example, interest rates. They affect long-term, you know, intermediate long-term bonds, but they also affect utilities and telecom and real estate stocks, right? Different factors in the marketplace can affect different asset classes very, very similarly and very differently as well. So understanding those dynamics are important. Now that's Invest Talk 101. Do you have a question you'd like answered? Send me a note. Click on the Contact Justin button on investtalk.com. Now we're coming up in the last segment of the hour. Let's try to get your question to us. Call us now at 888-99-CHART.
Our podcast distribution is made possible every day by KPP Financial. Steve Peasley, President. And if you're an InvestTalk insider, then you've already received Steve's latest portfolio management piece called Psychology and Investing. It's the latest offering for InvestTalk insiders. Why not sign up yourself? It's free on investtalk.com.
Let's go to Stephanie in Santa Clara. How are you doing, Stephanie?
I'm good, Justin. How are you?
Doing well. What can I do for you?
I have a question about Royal Cruise Lines. I mean, you know, their stock went down today, but I want to get it somehow at a good price. What do you think?
What do you think that price is what you're asking?
The price or?
Well, no, are you asking me when is a good price? Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Well, I know the PE is like in the 20-22s. Mm-hmm. And it dropped, so I don't know if I should buy it around that price, or should I just wait a little longer, till it goes sideways?
It's definitely not looking good from a weekly and daily chart standpoint. It's weak. It does have some support around this 200-day moving average around $70 a share. So there's definitely some support there. Now, our value is somewhere in the high 60s. And it's at 72, 71 now. So it's to me, it's gone from decently overvalued to only slightly overvalued. So I would wait on this name. I mean, what's your time horizon? Are you looking 5 years, you know, 5 years, 5-10 plus years, or, you know, 1 to 2 years?
I'm looking to hold on to it for long term.
Okay.
You know, passive.
Okay.
Income.
Well, then I think you have some ways to go. I think this at some point in the next couple of years, you're going to get this name back below $60 a share, and that's when I would pick it up. You know, if low 50s, 52, that's where I would initiate a purchase. And if it gets back into the mid 40s, then I'd really, really buy it hand over fist. So I think you got a little while. It's weak. I think if oil prices recover, that's also going to weigh on the stock. You had poor bookings, and you know, after a big run and it starts to come off like this, you have a lot of potential sellers that are looking to take profits, and you know, I think this is just the start of their problems in the near term. But I do like that this is on your watch list. This is something that you are looking to buy and own for the long term, because I think it is a good company. I've been on their cruises. The yield right now is only 1.4%. That's not that fantastic. I would want something over 2 for me to get excited about this name. And the profitability standpoint is good, but it's not to the point where I love it at this point. So I would wait a little bit longer.
How about KO?
KO, you know, that's another one that's weak as well. You know, that's expensive for the everyone's chasing that yield. I'm not a big fan of KO either. I want KO in the low 30s. I wouldn't buy KO into the low 30s, because I think there's a kind of a secular decline with their traditional beverage, and I think they have helped themselves with diversification, but the return on equity is weakening, some profitability metrics are weakening, and their growth is not strong. So I would wait on KO as well. Thanks for calling, Stephanie. Now I want to talk quickly about the telecom sector, AT&T and Verizon. I get this a lot. We own Verizon for our managed accounts in two of our strategies. And we like Verizon. And this is interesting, because this is an article from Morningstar, and it was great because it talked about AT&T and Verizon. And I said, AT&T, while it yields more, and a lot of people are going to say, I want to own AT&T because it has a higher yield. It yields, I think, a 0.5% or so higher than Verizon. There's been issues with AT&T and their capital allocation strategy. First, they bid for T-Mobile, which ended in a gigantic breakup fee, plus they lost some spectrum to T-Mobile, and they really got nothing out of it, nothing out of it. Then they decided to do share buybacks when the stock was expensive. Then they bought some assets in Mexico. Then they paid way too much for some spectrum related to DirecTV and the cable and broadcasting. And it just, they seem to be spending money, and they can afford it, but they're leveraging up their balance sheet to do it. They're bad. They're allocating their capital poorly. And Verizon is doing a much better job. So the growth potential in Verizon is much better. They cover their dividend a lot more than AT&T does, and they're just their dividend safer. They have better growth potential. They're allocating their capital smarter, and it's just a better company to be invested over the long term. So it's a good example of how you can't just fixate yourself on yield and say that's a better investment, because it is not a lot of the times. You have to look at the big picture and not just one factor. Now, before we close the hour, question, where can you get a no-cost portfolio review? Well, meet with Steve for an individual review of your retirement accounts. And it can be an occasion to ask questions and learn about your options. It's easy to get time right there on investtalk.com. I'm portfolio manager Justin Klein, and for Steve Peasley and everyone at KPP Financial, thank you for listening, and we'll hope you'll join us again on the next Invest Talk.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing.